Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you on a record-breakingly hot day in the mountains of Utah. Today's guest is podcaster, host, and all-around media personality, Veronica Belmont. Reading listeners will know Veronica from her book club podcasts, Sword and Laser, and Vaginal Fantasy, while the more tech-savvy will know her as the speaker, host, and presenter of a number of shows for CNET, Gizmodo, Sony, and more. I spoke with Veronica about her career, her love of books, emotional burnout, motherhood, and, of course, the pandemic. It was a wonderful chat. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Veronica Belmont.
It's really, I was talking to my mom recently, and I was like, I know I'm going to be 39 this year. So I think we're of an age. And
yeah.
I was like, in my mind, I still feel like I'm 25. Like in my brain, I still feel like a young, much younger person. And she was like, yeah, me too. In my brain, I still think that I'm like 25 and she's almost 70. And so it's like, oh no. Oh God. Okay. So we're just like this forever. And then eventually you're just old, but also still think you're young in your mind.
It's so true, though.
So I don't know if that's good or bad. Yeah.
Right. I'm tomorrow afternoon, my niece is going to college near me. And so she's flying in from out of the country, actually. Mm-hmm. And I got to pick her up tomorrow afternoon. And I'm thinking, you know, my 19-year-old niece, you know, I'll connect with her like I'm young and hip. And then I realized, oh, no, I'm not at all.
No, I think the only thing that keeps me feeling young is watching a lot of TikTok. I think that's the only way I know anything. Pretty sure.
I feel like that's not a great reflection on our generation, is it?
Well, I think it's a true reflection of us because we are the first real true internet generation, I would say. You know, we remember a time before,
yeah,
the before times, the before four.
Right.
But we also, you know, grew up with a lot of the things, the proto internet and the internet. And so now we're just, that's how we learn, is we jump into things and we kind of progress with them. And even though kids on TikTok make fun of like elder millennials for actually trying to use TikTok, I think it's super useful. And I think it's, you know, a lot of us are finding our own niches there, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird because I still have like this little bit in the back of my brain that's like, you know, when you talk about being like a gamer and stuff, people talk about Blizzard. And to me, Blizzard is still Warcraft orcs versus humans. You know, yeah. Like there's that like weird little disconnect that even though I was super young when it came out, it still feels like, oh, that's the entry to gaming.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not anymore. Not even close.
No, I know. I'm a former, I can't even call myself a gamer anymore because I haven't played a game since I was pregnant. So now it's like, I just don't play video games anymore, I guess. I don't even know what's going on. Like you've been playing that cool Viking game, right?
Oh man, I put way too much time into Valheim. It's,
yeah.
And it's like early release. Like they haven't even put out the first big like content update yet.
Really?
Which they had said was going to be by the end of May, and we're almost to the end of May, and I'm having that thing where I'm like, okay, they blew up. They didn't realize they were going to sell 7 million copies.
Oh no.
And they had to hire a bunch of people. I'm trying to like really be understanding, but there's that like gamer thing in the back of my head going, you need to put out content. I've got an addiction to you now.
What are you even doing over there?
Right.
Yeah, that game looks awesome. I don't have a gaming PC anymore, though. I gave my old gaming PC to my small 9-year-old friend. And so now he's rot, like it was a powerful gaming PC. And now he's just cranking on Minecraft. So that makes me feel pretty good.
Nice. Yeah, Valheim's like, It's like, I don't know, Viking Minecraft. It's not quite Minecraft because it's not that, you know, interactive, I guess, with the environment and stuff. But it's stupidly fun.
Yeah. Well, maybe when they port it to Mac, I'll hop on Steam there, hopefully, and eventually. If they always eventually come out for Mac.
Yeah.
Maybe.
See, I'm like growing up kind of, I grew up as a PC gamer and as a, and with my computer, it's mostly writing and gaming. And so anytime I talk to somebody who has a Mac, I go, why? And then I realize, oh, because Macs are super useful for tons of other things other than what you use them for, Brian.
Yeah, I was, I mean, I grew up as a console gamer and then I became a PC gamer. Really? Well, I had a PC growing up, but I was way more into like Nintendo and PlayStation and GameCube and those kinds of things until pretty much until I went to college. And then I had a, you know, a big boxy PC that I did all my work on, and that became like kind of like my proto gaming PC. And then when I kind of like moved out to San Francisco, I had switched to like this Mac G4 tower. And so there weren't really that many games you could play on that at the time. And then I wanted to play, I can't remember if I had a PC already that I was using for gaming or if I decided that I wanted to play World of Warcraft. And so I got a PC, but somewhere those two things happened around the same time. And then it was just, I became totally PC obsessed until like last year. And once in a while I would hop back into Xbox games or PlayStation because I worked for PlayStation for a while. But yeah, it was always coming back to World of Warcraft and stuff like that for a really, really long time.
The great addiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh man. I did WoW for many years, but then my big addiction was League of Legends.
Oh yeah.
And I had to go cold turkey. I haven't played it for probably 6 years now, just because.
Ooh, wow.
I had to just stop because I was putting so many hours into it. And those type of games, they cost so much rage, you know? those like really competitive games like that. Like I was like, I am not a healthy person when I'm playing this game.
I would get into games for a while and just kind of play them to death, like Skyrim and Fallout. And the last one I played, really, really played for a long time was Witcher 3. And I think I was over 200 hours in that game. So that was, and then I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like I cannot, like between work and Sword and Laser and all the other stuff I was doing, I was like, this is just becoming unhealthy. So, and now I literally just don't have any time. So it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something's got to give.
It's because you just had a kid.
I did.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. He's going to be 6 months old soon.
Ooh, man.
Yeah.
Getting old.
I know, time flies.
That's funny. Like
him and not me, right?
of course.
Okay.
All right. No, you're still in your 20s, right? We already discussed.
Oh yeah,
that.
25. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Cuz I've got a bunch of nieces and nephews, and Michelle has a bunch of nieces and nephews, and so we don't really feel the need to have our own children because there's so many. Mm-hmm. Both of us come from big families.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the youngest of 6. And she's the middle of 5. And so there's just lots of kids. And so I've got the benefits of being able to be a cool uncle occasionally, but the, you know, not having to actually have the responsibility of raising a child.
Oh, yeah.
I do not trust myself with.
You'd be surprised. I mean, I'm not going to speak for everyone, but I also went through my entire life. I think I mentioned I'm going to be 39 soon. And so I was pretty much like, oh, this is, you know, I'm not going to do this thing. And then we just kind of decided that we were ready and that it was time. And it happened over the pandemic, which was unexpected and unanticipated, but you know, whatever, you know, you just got to go with it.
Right.
And I didn't know what I was doing at all either because I had never planned for that. And so I just kind of, you figure it out. And I'm fortunate to have a lot of girlfriends and family friends and my mom who were able to walk me through some of the finer points of what was going to happen. But otherwise, yeah, I have surprised myself with being intuitive, and maybe that's not everybody and that's totally fine. You know, it's, I'm glad we did it so far.
Yeah. Until you have to teach them how to drive, right?
Oh God, why do we let children drive at 16?
Because
why did anyone let us drive at 16?
Because we could reach the pedals.
Terrible idea.
I mean, like, I know it was for me is because my dad was sick of going to the post office to check his PO box.
It's like you're super specific.
No, it is like so many like steps in my life where my dad's sick of doing this and I'm big enough to do it. You know, learning how to use the hand mower like at 10. You know, why would you give a spinning blade to a child unless you're really sick of doing it yourself?
The 80s and 90s were different times.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, you know, what it comes down to. So, yeah, we had a different learning curve, I think, for entry into adulthood.
So you're not a native San Franciscan then?
No, I grew up in Connecticut. I moved.
Oh, wow. So you're an East Coaster then.
Yeah. Yeah. So pretty soon I will have lived here in San Francisco as long as I lived in Connecticut. I moved out here to San Francisco in 2004, right after I graduated college. So yeah, coming up on I don't know. It's been a minute.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. So I've had a couple of friends you relocate to the West Coast, and I'm from Ohio, which is, you know, technically Midwest, but kind of East Midwest, you know, area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a weird jump, because I always one of my best friends moved out there like right after college, and I always made fun of him for it, because like, come on, we're Midwest kids, you know, how would you betray like the homeland by going to California? And 5 or 6 years ago, I went and I visited him finally and spent a weekend with him, and he's just right down there in Redwood.
In Redwood City.
And I spent a weekend and walking around, and I'm like, okay, the weather, it's gorgeous. Things are just nice. All right, I get it.
Yeah, that's a nice area. San Francisco is cold. So today it's 60 right now in San Francisco.
It's not cold.
Which is fine. No, I know it's not cold, but comparatively speaking, I'm going tomorrow to a reservoir to go swimming with some friends in East Bay, in an area called Antioch, and it's going to be 85. But the day after, it's going to be 100.
Ooh.
And that's an hour away. So that just kind of shows like how San Francisco is very isolated and I guess insulated from the more extreme weather surrounding it because of the fog system that we live in.
Right. Right. It's some weird weather.
Yeah.
I remember just driving over the mountains to go to the coast and it was just like gigantic storms and then beautiful weather.
Yeah.
And it, very weird.
Yeah, I like it though. I like that you can drive to the beach, or you can drive to the mountains and go skiing, or you can be in the desert. Everything is just a few hour drive in either direction. So it's fun if you like outdoorsy stuff and camping and hiking or skiing or adventure type things, which I love all of that. So it's hard to find that kind of variety anywhere else in the country.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Now, so you've been, since about 2005, you've been pretty much solid in the hosting and podcast and like just the tech world in general.
Yeah. We were podcasting at CNET before podcasting was the word for it, really. And before it was like an official thing on iTunes. So that was my first like producing and hosting gig was back in 2004, 2005 for CNET, where of course is where I met Tom, who's my co-host on Sword and Laser.
Yeah.
And yeah, we've been doing that show since 2007. So it's been actually, he's going to be so mad at me. I'm doing your show before I go back on Sword and Laser next week because I've been away for maternity leave.
It's all right. This won't be out for a bit. So it's okay.
Okay. Phew. You know, Belmont, you did McClellan's show before you came back to your own show. I love podcasting. And it's so amazing how much it's grown and changed and evolved in the past 10 years and even more so in the past four years, with some of the big hits that have come out. Now I don't even know what to listen to because there's just so many options. I don't know where to start. I get overwhelmed.
Well, and coming from kind of my perspective, which is the book world, mm-hmm. like just audio entertainment has just blown up in general.
Yeah.
Audio sales, you know, audio sales 10 years ago were hardly anything. You know, it was just this, you'd get a massive case of CDs from the library or something.
Right.
And it's just, it's changed so much. And now I think audio is like 20% of my income. You know, like
that's amazing.
It's a huge difference.
Yeah. I can pretty much only listen to audiobooks now because I don't, by the time I go to bed at night, I'm so exhausted. I can't keep my eyes open to read a paper book. But if I'm putting the kid down or going, taking the dogs for a walk or cleaning up around the house, I can listen to audiobooks. So it's made multitasking a lot easier, and it gives me a lot of enjoyment to be able to do those things and have a book or a really good podcast. Oh, I just listened. Do you like baseball?
You know what?
Baseball guy.
I was huge in baseball when I was a kid, when the Cleveland Indians were like always good in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And I just totally fell off the wagon after about 2002, I think.
Okay. So there's a really great podcast about the Astros sign stealing scandal called The Edge.
Yeah.
And it is like, it's like a 6-part series about the sign stealing conundrum issue from the 2017 years surrounding that years. And it was like, oh, it was so riveting. It was really great. So that's a recommendation for people who are interested in baseball or not legal stuff, but more like the science of scouting and baseball and how teams are using economics and things like that to improve their stats and chances of winning. But also this like element of sign stealing, which is like more kind of overlooked and kind of like, you know, swept under the rug in terms of rules that are broken and but everyone does it apparently.
That's interesting. I remember back in the day when I was really into baseball, my dad and I talked about it a lot. Mm-hmm. And I remember him telling me about, you know, like, I don't even know what teams it was or anything, but like, you know, guys sitting, you know, way out in the outfield with, you know, binoculars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, just trying to figure out what was going on and having, you know, little earpieces and things. And
so that's the thing. They can do that. But as soon as they start using electronics is when it becomes like totally forbidden.
Okay.
So, yeah. So if you're like in the dugout or if you're on second base and you start kind of cracking the code behind the signs that are getting thrown and you can kind of communicate using like foot signals or hand signals or things like that to the batter, that's one thing. Like you can kind of get away with that. But as soon as you start using like TV monitors or, you know, buzzers or microphones or things like that, that's now when you can really get in trouble.
Right. It becomes like an espionage operation.
Totally. It's totally espionage. That's absolutely what it is.
So is it almost considered like a sort of corporate espionage in the baseball world?
It's kind of, you can kind of liken it to, they make a comparison to, what's it called when you're insider trading?
Yeah.
I guess they kind of compared it to insider trading a little bit. But yeah, it's like kind of like corporate espionage because I mean, these teams are corporations and they're moneymakers in a way. And, you know, just the counter espionage that goes on,
right?
Like when they go to away teams and they'll send spies to the other dugout to like try to see if they have monitors so they can tattle on them before the series starts. It's pretty wild, but sorry, I didn't mean to turn this into a baseball podcast.
No, that's great. I'm always fascinated by that stuff. And, you know, like back to like podcasts and things, I love that those sort of things, I love that you almost get like mini series with these podcasts that are very informative. And even if you're not really well versed in a subject, you can go and listen to something that's 6 or 12 hours long. Like for me, it's Hardcore History.
I knew you were going to say that. As soon as you started talking about that format, I was like, Hardcore History is like the best one at that.
I absolutely adore it. It's just the best. And it's, and you know, for writers, you know, stuff like Hardcore History, the Revolutions podcast, you know, things like that, like, man, it's just killer. It's so, so inspiring and interesting because it gets into the like, the stranger than fiction sort of realities that happened before, you know, we were alive, you know, in long, long time ago, interesting intricacies of you know, what it's like to live in the medieval era or whatever.
Yeah, I loved the one on the Mongols. I think that was like that was like a super intense one. Yeah. So what's his name?
Dan Carlin.
Dan Carlin. Yeah, I'm just so impressed by his writing and his ability to kind of. I heard once that he just the sheer amount of time it takes to research and write and produce every like series is pretty incredible.
Well, it's yeah, and it's got to be because when you look at the footnotes for that, it's like 30, 40 books, you know?
Yeah.
That's like that. I write for a living and I don't read that many books.
Yeah, that's true. Good point.
Like it's genuinely impressive. I love that kind of stuff. So you kind of. Over the last few years, you mentioned when we were emailing back and forth that you've transitioned mostly away from hosting gigs.
Yeah.
You know, so what's been kind of behind that?
Yeah, it was kind of a slow burn for a while there. I for those who kind of don't know my history, which I assume is most people listening to this show, I you know made my career for a long time doing like sponsored content, branded content, like podcasts, things like that. I did a show for Mozilla for a long time. I worked with a lot of brands like Dice.com and IBM to create content. But then I also did a lot of video and TV work as well. And I had been trying to get that side of things going for 10 years. And it's just a really hard industry to break into. And I live in San Francisco. I don't live in LA or New York. So that made it even a little more, kind of upped the difficulty rating a little bit for that kind of job. And so after a while, I just got kind of tired. Like I had been freelancing for so long and it was really fun. And I love taking on new projects and working on new projects with new people. But eventually I was like, oh, I kind of wish I could just like have coworkers that I could see all the time and go get drinks with and take regular vacations and not feel like I had to do the whole freelancer hustle deal, like even when I was traveling for pleasure or enjoyment. And so I kind of spent a lot of time, you know, and honestly, there was kind of like one moment that really kind of solidified it for me. I was hosting the season 7 premiere of Game of Thrones for HBO, mm-hmm. Which was amazing. It was an incredible night. I had so much fun. And then afterwards, I did the ultimate like stupid thing, which was I looked at like Twitter or Facebook to like follow the live stream.
Ooh.
And there wasn't even a lot of people. There was like one person that just was like harping on me because I had mispronounced something. And it's bound to happen. There's a lot of words in Game of Thrones that are not easy to pronounce. And so I said something wrong. They just like laid into me about it. And something in my brain just cracked. And I'm like, why, even though I just had this incredible night, this amazing opportunity that I'm so grateful for, so much fun. And yet I can just get like one comment that's just going to mess with my head for days. And I was like, I don't want to do that anymore. Like I'm fine putting myself out there, but I don't know if I want to be that vulnerable to strangers in that way anymore, where my happiness and my, you know, what makes me feel fulfilled is predicated on some random person on the internet's feedback. You know, it's like kind of a shitty way to live your life sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's hard for a lot of us to get away from because we do live such online lives. But, you know, so much of my job was kind of not rated on, but you know, I would get gigs based on social feedback or social following. And so that stuff was like an important metric for potential job opportunities. And just that pressure, I couldn't deal anymore. I was like, I want to be able to make my living doing work that I feel good about, that is, you know, helping people or helping people do something that's beneficial for them, without necessarily having to tie my whole personality and happiness to that outcome.
Well, and I bet it kind of made the transition to saying, you know, maybe I want to have a kid to be a little easier, didn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. I would say so. I think it's been nice to. I generally don't post pictures of him online. It's like not a thing it's something we've chosen not to do. There's a couple photos like from when he was first born, and there's a couple of photos with him with like sunglasses on, like he's, you know, hiding from the paparazzi. But ultimately, like I wanted him to be able to make that decision. And, you know, when he is older to not necessarily feel like his entire life has already been placed on the internet for tons of people to see. It's kind of an unusual decision, I think, in this modern times that we live in, I guess. But it felt right.
Yeah.
And it does make things kind of easier. Like, I was able to be a pregnant person and be sick and take time off and, you know, not be the same weight I am, not look the same. My hair is gray. My hair is falling out because that's a thing that happens after you have a baby.
Yeah.
Apparently. And I don't have to worry about, you know, that impacting my job. You know, I don't have to be on camera anymore. So it feels that made it a lot easier in a lot of ways. But kudos, huge props to the people who can do that. And, you know, it takes a special kind of person, a very differently strong kind of person to be able to keep themselves, you know, out there in the public eye while going through something so intensely personal.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, I've seen, you know, I was kind of trolling a little bit through your Twitter feed over the last, you know, like year or so, because I was before we were doing this. And
yeah.
And I was fascinated by a couple things. One was talking about going through your pregnancy while being so secluded mm-hmm. and being forced to be at home at all times. And that just like that. Like, especially it really connected with me when you mentioned that you couldn't even have your mom around. And, you know, and I'm still, you know, I'm a 35-year-old man with my own business, but sometimes I need my mommy, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's just fact. And I can't even imagine going through something like that and not be able to say, hey, come over, mom.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, I don't know if I would recommend people to have their first child during a pandemic. But, you know, we did try to make the best of it. I really did not feel comfortable having my mom fly out across the country. And there's no direct flight for her. So she'd have to like have a layover somewhere for like a couple hours and be on two pretty long flights. And so we made the decision together to wait until after she was fully vaccinated to come down. And that wasn't until, you know, March, really, I think March, somewhere around late February, March. I can't even remember when they started vaccinating people anymore. But she got it like the first like week or two. So that was really awesome. She got in super early.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, it was tough because my partner, Ryan, is just incredible and he's been amazing throughout this whole process. But yeah, it's nice to have your mom. It's nice to have your girlfriends. Like I wasn't able to do like the baby shower thing or, you know, really get to go hang out with them. But on the opposite side, looking on the bright side of things, it was really great. Like, especially when I was throwing up all day to not have to be in the office, and not have to call out of work or like, you know, be business on top and party on the bottom with my pajama pants on. Like when I had just woken up from a 3 o'clock nap, because I couldn't right. physically stay awake for more than like 2 hours at a time. Mm-hmm. So those were some of the benefits. My team, my manager was super understanding. But yeah, not having to be in the office during those times was, oh, I can't even imagine what that would have been like.
Yeah. And the other thing that kind of struck me was the comment about a baby being a career killer, which feels, I mean, I'm a dude. I can't really understand that and grapple with that entirely, but it feels so massively 90s mm-hmm. and
yeah.
horribly insensitive and not true. You know, I know plenty of moms that have way better careers than I do and mm-hmm. they're good at it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that it seems like such a, I don't know, it's a horrible thing to say to a person, especially just, you know, in person, you know?
Yeah. I don't remember the context of that comment.
I think it was a retweet of someone else who had run into that, of someone that they respected had made that comment to them.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's right. Yeah. Okay. I do remember that now. Yeah. It's hard because I actually know a friend of mine is going through fundraising right now for a company, and she does not want to tell her potential investors that she's pregnant.
Yeah.
Because she is certain that that's going to impact their perception of that process, and what she's capable of and what she can handle. And I mean, it's in some ways, so yeah, having a baby being a career killer, it is not true for many people, but it's not true, especially for people who have the privilege of being able to work like white collar jobs and have come work for companies like mine, for example, like Adobe, that is like super family oriented and has great maternal and paternal leave for employees. And even, but even by worldwide standards for Western civilization, you know, for Western cultures rather, it's still not amazing. Yeah. Like Canada has much better maternity leave. Much of Europe has much better maternity leave. But I'm happy with what I was able to get.
Right.
But people who don't work, these kinds of jobs, like don't have the, like, how are you going to go to work, you know, in an hourly job with kids, without being able to have time off, without support from your family? Like, there's so many people who just don't have the option of working and raising children and have to find other means. And it's just, it's unbelievable. Like, the choices that people, women especially, but also parents in general, have to make in order to have families and make a living wage. And then being able to find childcare later, like the fact that we don't have any kind of like free childcare for people up to a certain age, like that's really tough because you have to make that choice. It seems it's very unfair. And I think we can do a lot better in this country.
Do you spend a lot of time thinking about what your career path looks like the next 10 years with kind of a child in the mix?
Well, we are fortunate that I can have, you know, I do have help. But it's hard, you know. My mom was a single mom up until I was like 9. And so she worked for a big company. And so she had to have a nanny for me, childcare. We were very fortunate to be able to have that. And so she was able to keep doing her career until she decided to be a stay-at-home mom when my brother was born. I always kind of see that from that same path for myself. Like I love my job. I love my career. I want to keep getting better at it. I want to keep moving further in it. But again, I do have that, you know, that cushion of it being a big company that gives us a lot of time off and is flexible on hours. And that's why I moved into that world, because I wanted to be able to have that balance as much as possible. It's much harder as a freelancer. It's much harder when you have to be traveling like a number of weeks out of the year to go to gigs, to go to conferences, to do speaking engagements. I hope to be able to get back to that kind of, you know, I still do that as for Adobe as part of my evangelism work. But it's a lot easier, like, you know, being able to spread it out more and being able to make choices about what I want to do and what I don't want to do.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
So what is an evangelist?
So an evangelist in the corporate or tech world sense is someone who goes out and talks about your product and services to the general, you know, general audience of I don't know. Like, it's such a weird thing. It's such a weird word in that context, but that is literally my title. I go out and I speak about Spark, which is the product I work on at Adobe, at events. I host workshops, I do webinars, and basically kind of evangelize the product to the masses. So the people who, not necessarily selling, it's not like a marketing job per se. It's more like, this is what I know. This is what I'm knowledgeable in. Let me help you with my knowledge to, so you can achieve the goals that you have in the creative space.
Yeah. Now, do you do mostly public or private kind of presentations and things like that?
Both, actually. A surprising amount of internal like projects. Like my big project this week is talking about something we're working on to another group within Adobe. So that's a huge part of what I do, actually, is just because when you have 30,000 employees, like, everyone wants to know what's going on sometimes. But then I do a lot of stuff like speaking at our big trade show called Max every year. So I'll host workshops there or do kind of sessions talking about certain product features or goals that people are trying to achieve. But then also a lot of like going to general design conferences or events like VidCon or CES to do panels and talks there too.
Do you think that kind of fulfills the kind of sort of the niche inside of you that you used to get from going and doing that sort of thing freelance?
Yeah, I mean, I'm good at it. Like, that's something I'm good at. It's a skill I've cultivated over the past 15 years. Yeah. So it's useful to be able to take that ability to do public speaking and kind of be quick on my feet in those kinds of situations and translate that to helping the other part of my job, which is being a product manager.
I was watching a presentation that you did on YouTube from, I think, 2015. And I was thinking, 6 years ago, I could not string two words together in public. And Veronica's up there in front of thousands of people. Like, I have such a huge respect for people that are able to do that and do it not just well, but on a regular basis, and be able to both do a presentation, but also work the crowd a little bit. There's a lot going on in there.
It's so funny because still to this day, I'll psych myself out before something like that. I think I'm guessing you're talking about the XOXO talk that I did.
I think that was it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I will admit to you that I was sobbing in the hallway, not 15 minutes before I was up on that stage.
Well, you definitely couldn't tell.
Like, throwing up with fear.
Oh my goodness.
And
well, that makes me feel a little bit better about that, like, hard pit in my stomach whenever I go to a panel at a convention.
It's totally natural. And I think the one thing that does come with time and practice is that once you get up there, instinct takes over. And so even though I was nervous going into it, the second I got up on stage, I was like, oh, I've done this before. Your body kind of takes over, your training kind of takes over. And that helps. And so you do learn that with time. I think, I don't know if the nerves will ever really go away. But what has improved is the recovery time once actually getting up on stage.
That's good to know. As someone who hopes to do more kind of things in public, especially now that COVID lockdown is kind of starting to go away, at least.
Yeah.
You know, I
just always think of it as like, it's a conversation, you know, for panels and stuff like that. Like, you're the expert. Like, people are there to see you. They want to hear what you have to say. Like, you don't have to worry about... That's why I think cons are so fun, because you get to go as like an expert in this thing that you super nerd out on or you're a super expert on, like, and people just want to talk about it. Like, they're all there because they're excited to talk about it too. It's just your people, you know?
Right. And I guess I'm fortunate I work in kind of an industry that's going to be a little smaller and less public eye than what you do.
You know, who knows?
So what have you been reading lately? Have you gotten, you mentioned that you're kind of switched mostly to audiobooks. Is there anything that's been striking you?
Yeah. So I just, other than that podcast, that wasn't really a book that I just listened to. I'm reading right now A Desolation Called Peace, from Arkady Martin, who did, an empire. What was it? What was the first book called? the I remember what the first book was called. It was so good. Hold on. Frantically kicking through, clicking. A Memory Called Empire was the first book.
Oh, that's right. I saw that one everywhere. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So that was fantastic. And then the second book is a Desolation Called Peace. And so I'm reading that one right now. And it's super good. That one I'm actually reading. So I'm reading that one. Before that, I read, I listened to The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue by V.E. Schwab. And that was phenomenal. And then before that, I listened to The House in the Cerulean Sea by T.J. Klune, which was phenomenal, just like unbelievably good. So if you're looking for something to pick up, I thought that that audiobook in particular was killer, was so fun.
Was that one, I might be conflating things, but was that one, it got a bit in the Love, Death, and Robots on Netflix?
I don't think so. First season?
Maybe I'm conflating it with something else.
Good question. No, I don't think there was anything. It's funny because I just watched the second season of Love, Death, and Robots.
Yeah.
A lot of no robots in this season.
Right, right.
A lot of love and death. Is it sex and robots?
Maybe that's what it is. I keep forgetting what it's called.
I think it's sex, but I feel like there were way fewer robots this season than last season.
Yeah, there was the John Scalzi penned one that was like the first or second one in this season.
It was the first one, yeah, with the vacuum. Roomba, the murderous Roomba. Yeah,
that's great.
I actually went back and watched his first one because he also did the first story of the first season, which is the three robots that go back to Earth.
Right.
And I don't want to spoil it, but another species has taken over. And to me, that is still like one of my favorite shorts of his.
That was great. I loved that. I loved both of those anthology seasons. And I'd love to see more of that kind of thing, just because it's almost like a little variety show, you know?
Yeah. I think it's fun to be able to. I agree. Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. I just agree.
So I think it was the same clip that I had mentioned earlier, and you introduce yourself as an aspiring writer of erotic genre fiction. And I was curious whether that was a joke or if you actually do some writing on the side.
You know, I have not written anything in that particular genre. I think it was just from doing the other podcast that I hosted for 5 or 6 years, Vaginal Fantasy, that made me want to get into that space. I have written some things. I don't think they're very good, but that's okay. I think, you know, everyone starts somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
I did NaNoWriMo for a number of years. I actually had the fortune slash misfortune of being beta read by Patrick Rothfuss.
Oh, man.
And it was he was so sweet and so nice, and he read the whole thing, and I have never been more mortified in my entire life. It was one of the situations where, like, I felt like I couldn't say no, because how often do you have an opportunity to have something like that? Like, someone, you know, he's such an amazing writer and such a great guy to read something that you've written. And and I'm embarrassed to say that I've never gone back and tried to do any rewrites or anything. I can't even look at it. Like, I'm so horrified. But I did have something published in an anthology from John Joseph Adams. It was a collection of short stories about like fantastical Kickstarters. And I don't know why I'm forgetting the name right now. But I did have a short story in that, and that's the only thing I've published. It's the only thing.
Yeah.
And that's probably the way it'll stay.
You don't think you're going to throw your all into the writing genre?
I don't know. I've thought about it so many times to just try, but honestly, I'm leaving it to the professionals. We did a short story anthology for Sword and Laser years ago, and Tom and I have always talked about doing another one. I loved slush reading. I loved putting the anthology together. I loved editing. So that kind of thing, I think I would like to continue to do in the future, whether it's for Sword and Laser or for other projects. But writing for myself is, I'm not like Tom. Tom is so prolific. Like, he can just write and write and write. He does NaNoWriMo every year, and he puts out like a novel a year. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. And he's just good at that. And to me, it's not, I can't seem to get my head together to make that something I do in my free time.
Yeah. I've talked before about that. If I was better at something else that made me more money, I'd probably be doing that.
Oh, but you then know, we'd all be so sad.
Right. But I love writing, but like, there is a point at which if all of my energy was going into something different, that, you know, I don't think I would want my free time to be trying to create something, mm-hmm. because, you know, it's like a level of creative energy. It wipes you out. And, you know, the idea of coming home from like a real day job, you know, I did that for many years. I came home from a real day job and wrote, and honestly, it sucks.
Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard. I wish people, readers, sometimes appreciated how hard it is. And I've barely even done it. I can't even imagine for folks like you that do it as your primary gig. Like, it's a lot.
Well,
so good on you.
I mean, I am fortunate that it can be my only thing. And so I'm able to, you know, just, I'm able to do it when I can and I've got the energy and things. But, you know, I'm always kind of jealous of the type of people who can sit down every single weekday and write a certain number of words at the same time. Mm-hmm. I think it was Kevin Hearn was told me that he does 500 words a day, period. And like that, you know, it feels like I'll talk about being able to, I can put out 6,000 to 8,000 words in a day if I really need to, mm-hmm. but you know, kind of big chunks. So 500 words seems small, but when you take that and you multiply that by the days in the year, he writes a lot more than I do. And he gets to say, you know, I'm done by 2 o'clock or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's something I've always been really jealous of.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like when I was doing those kind of writing projects like Nano, like being able to, I mean, forcing yourself to write, what is it, like 1,600 words a day?
Yeah.
Minimum, just to keep it within the month. Whoa. And if you miss a day, whoa. Like, the way it all starts kind of compounding after that is terrifying.
Right.
But it feels really good when you do it, like when you get it done, get it out of the way for the day. Or if you kind of get into a flow and you're writing even more than that. I think that's getting into that flow state, I think, is kind of the goal that I would want to achieve. And I don't know if I have the attention span to be able to get into that kind of brain space anymore.
When you were freelancing, did you find that the projects you were working on kind of consumed your every waking moment, at least in the back of your head?
Oh yeah. I mean, it totally depends, but certain things, especially the more kind of public, like high profile things. Yeah. Even when you're not actively working on them, they are, like you said, just kind of sitting in the back of your mind and taking up space and taking up mental load and energy, just anticipating having to do them. And also, so many of them involve travel. And I used to have real high anxiety about like traveling and being late to things or being on time. And so that would kind of add to the overall anxiety factor of freelance work.
Yeah. So what are you passionate about at the moment?
Other than the baby, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, the baby is a very valid answer.
Yeah, it's kind of the baby. Just like keeping him alive and figuring out like all of the things. I'm kind of in a weird space right now because I do have a lot of physical like things I like to do, like rock climbing and weightlifting and all these other things that I literally can't do right now because of the things that happened to my body during labor and pregnancy, and the after effects of that. So I'm still working on getting my kind of body back to a place where I can do the things I'm passionate about. Especially now that things are opening up, like the climbing gyms and outdoor climbing spaces, like that's kind of my favorite thing to do, like on off work hours, is to do that. But yeah, I'm just trying to like find time for myself to do the things that I love, like being able to read and being able to get outdoors and that kind of thing. It's tough, but I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot that I'm passionate about. I think I love reading. I love being outside, and that's kind of all I have space for at the moment.
Do you think that being a person with a lot of different passions kind of helped you get through lockdown? Or do you think that was a greater challenge because you couldn't reach many of those
passions? Yeah, it was really hard, I think, to not be able to do any of that stuff, because I was very like, loved going to the gym, I loved going to work. Like I loved my office. I really enjoy spending time with my coworkers and being there. And so that was already stressful and sad, like when lockdown started, to not be able to have that. And then, you know, add in the extra isolation of the pregnancy and the sickness and all that stuff, which was hard. But yeah, I mean, I did get a lot of shows watched. I watched a lot of really good television.
That's not just you. Like, I think everybody was catching up on their reading and their watching. I mean, I know that my own personal like backlist sales went up by like 30% for most of last year.
Wow, nice.
Like, just people wanting to get some ebooks and read and catch up on their lists and things.
It was funny taking maternity leave from Sword and Laser, because I've always had like a book a month that I'm supposed to definitely have to read. And for the first time, I was like, I can read whatever I want. I can go back to all those series I never finished and read through those, or I can just pick up like some short story collection and read that. And so that was kind of fun and cool. Like I read all of the Murderbot stories. Like I just like dived into the Murderbot series and read all of those. I finished all the Becky Chambers books that I had. I actually started rereading Dresden Files, because I had fallen off the Dresden Files wagon for a while, and I was like, I don't even remember the first book anymore. So I went back and reread the first book and started the series over. So it was fun to kind of be able to just feel like a fan reader instead of a quasi-professional reader.
Oh yeah, for sure. I've found that since I became an epic fantasy writer, like for a living, I just don't read that much. You know, occasionally I'll do audiobooks, but I feel like I've switched almost all to history.
Interesting.
Because it's interesting to me, and because it's inspiration. Mm-hmm. And so like, even sometimes sitting down to watch like a drama of any kind feels like work, because my brain's constantly thinking, oh, well, what's the next thing the character's going to do? Well, the writers could have taken this choice and they could have taken that choice, and, you know, they could go this direction. And so it feels like I'm always working. So I end up doing lots of documentaries and lots of history and things like that.
Are we going to get some Bridgerton inspiration in one of your future books?
the next series that's out next in 2022, June, that one's going to be, that is all Revolutions podcast inspired. I love combining the cool stuff from history with worlds that have magic and me not having to do actual historical research.
Nice.
That combo, it's fantastic. So I've got one more question for you before I'm going to let you go. And this one's important. It's very close to my heart.
Yeah.
What's the last meal that blew your mind?
Okay. Well, I actually had dinner that we picked up from this Hawaiian restaurant in town called Liho, and it was so good. And I mean, I don't like kind of branch out into, we have our restaurants that we go to like fairly regularly. Like we cook at home. Yeah. And we usually eat at home like 3 or 4 nights out of the week. And then the other nights we'll like get out, but we'll get enough out that we can get for like have leftovers for the next couple of nights. Right. And this one only lasted one night because we ate everything. And it was just like really incredible Hawaiian food. And I've been craving it like ever since then. And yeah, so that's the best meal that I've had in a really long time. Liho Liho in the Mission. It's on 18th Street. It's a new spot and super, super yummy.
So when you say Hawaiian food, like the only Hawaiian I have any experience with is kind of chain restaurant Hawaiian barbecue. Is it going to be familiar to that sort of thing?
Well, they do have like, I mean, they do have some spam musubi, which is like a pretty popular Hawaiian dish. But this place, like, so I'm pescatarian, so I eat fish, but otherwise I'm vegetarian. Okay. But they have stuff like chicken wings and short ribs, like Korean style short ribs and spam steak. and they have tuna poke and all sorts of stuff like that. And what else? I'm trying to see what other stuff that they really had.
What are the veggie options? Like for somebody for a, I've never been able to pronounce piscuit.
Pescatarian.
I'm terrible at it. Pescatarian.
Pescatarian. So just think like the Latin word for fish is like
pescatarian.
P-E-S-C-E, I think.
I think so, yeah.
So pesca. So it's like pescatarian, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so yeah, we got like a fish and we got there's cabbage and roasted turnips and just I think we had a little gem salad. But I am like my favorite food is pizza. So if you were about to ask me what my last meal was going to be, it would definitely be pizza.
Oh man, I discovered way too recently Gold Belly.
I know.
And I love Chicago deep dish.
Oh my god.
And I realized that if I order a biggest thing I can of Lou Malnati's deep dish frozen pizzas, it's about the same cost as just getting delivery per pizza. And I get to eat Lou Malnati's at home.
Do you have like a giant, like one of those like meat locker freezers?
We've got a small chest freezer.
In your house?
So yeah.
I was going to say, yeah. So Gold Belly is like, or Good Belly.
Gold Belly.
Which is it? Is it Gold Belly or Good Belly? Gold Belly?
I think it's Gold Belly.
Yeah. So that is like my go-to now for like gifts for people. Cause it's like, nobody expects it. But like the other day, one of my best friend had her birthday. She's from New York. And I got her like a whole platter of like bagels from New York City. Ooh. With like the schmear and all the stuff. And it was like straight out of New York. So it was like perfect, like really good.
That's fantastic.
And like, you're never going to expect any huge shipment of like bagels and schmear and lox and all that good stuff. So yeah, it's a great, really great gift idea too. But I haven't used it for myself yet.
You know, honestly, I've barely used it for other people. So I should keep that in mind. That is a good gift idea. But hey, Veronica, thank you so much for coming on and taking your time to just chat away with me.
Of course, it was super fun. And you've been on Sword and Laser so many times and you've been such a great friend of the show that I'm happy to do it. Happy to do it either way.
It's always a blast. Thank you so much.
That was Veronica Belmont. Thanks again to Veronica for joining me. You can find links to Veronica's social media down in the show notes. You can find me, as usual, at brianmcclellan.com. One small note about a reference we made to the Netflix show, Love, Death, and Robots. I was conflating two different stories when Veronica mentioned House on the Cerulean Sea. I was thinking of Zima Blue, which is based on a short story of the same name by Alastair Reynolds. So if you're looking to go pull that out at a party, don't make the same mistake I did. You'll look like a fool. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production support. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. Don't forget to like and subscribe.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.